Welcome to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz, a candid conversation as we learn about dementia, Alzheimer's, and its effects on the people we love. Jill's years of dedication and experience help you adapt, recover, overcome obstacles, and help find a positive outcome. It's time for Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Good morning, listeners. It's going to be a beautiful week in the Mile High City, and I'm excited because I've invited a guest today I've wanted to have on for a long, long time. Welcome, Dr. Jonathan Woodcock.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
How are you today?
I'm doing great.
Great. So you work with the Rocky Mountain Alzheimer's Disease Center.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and you're the doctor that people will call and make an appointment with when they think they have some type of memory loss or someone they care for has some type of memory loss and make an appointment?
Yes, I'm the clinical director of the center, and I help to run the clinic operation as well as the clinical research. We have a number of different doctors who people may see as they come in.
Okay, so there's a lot of confusion out there. Jonathan, I'm going to call you Jonathan. There's a lot of confusion out there about the difference between Alzheimer's and normal aging. So when someone comes in, either for themselves or with someone they're caring for, how do you determine if what their symptoms are real precursors or biomarkers or whatever you want to call it towards Alzheimer's, and what's normal?
There are changes in cognition, in thinking, in memory as we get older, but those changes tend to be very gradual, and they don't tend to cause major problems in people's lives in getting along. So if people have consistent progressive problems in getting along, then they probably should talk to their doctor. However, because there are changes in what we call normal cognitive aging that do affect memory and attention and our what we call executive abilities or our problem-solving abilities, then we can sometimes overreact to things too. We make a cognitive error or a cognitive mistake, and people may begin to think that they have the beginnings of Alzheimer's disease when it's really normal cognitive aging. The fact is that we all make cognitive mistakes throughout our lives.
Right.
But as we get older, sometimes people get sensitive about that. And when people get sensitive, then they can get anxiety about performance. Mm-hmm. And that performance anxiety can interfere more with function than even the cognitive aging.
I think that's really well said, especially if someone has this in their family and they're very hypersensitive to it. So when the folks that I work with come to me and they're really concerned about, maybe if I'm just at a lecture or something and they're concerned about, gosh, I keep forgetting things. I tell them, you know, we're in an overstimulated world. If you forget something, that's okay. If you forget its purpose, say, for example, keys, if they're looking at keys and they don't understand what their purpose is, that could be a problem as opposed to just being an unorganized person that loses their keys often because they don't put them in the same place.
That's right. People who have family histories, and today many people are getting various kinds of genetic tests, and so people can get very worried about these errors when they're occurring. So when people come in, we get a very detailed history about the kinds of problems they're having, but we also like to hear from people who are around them, who are seeing them on a regular basis, to see what their perspective of things is, because often it'll be very different. The spouse, for instance, may say, well, he makes mistakes once in a while, but it's really no different than it's been in the past. But he has a family history. He's retired 2 years ago, and he finds that he's more upset when he makes a mistake than he used to be.
Right. So I have to ask you, it must be a difficult position for you to be in, although it's one that you've trained for and it's what your job is, but delivering that news to someone that, in fact, they may have Alzheimer's type dementia and their families. How do you help in that moment when someone receives that news?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of things we do in the moment, and I think the most important thing is probably what we've done before that moment to prepare ourselves to help them with this information. As I've done this over the years, though, I've been impressed by several things. First of all, patients and their families want to know. So not knowing is sometimes more difficult than knowing.
Right.
And that's something that really helps motivate all of us to get the very best answer we can and to share that with patients and families. Sometimes we don't have all the answers also, and that's even more difficult for folks, I think, when we have uncertainty than when we have a certain diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that we find so consistently, it really blows me away, is that people are very grateful for the information. And as hard as the visit is when we give people the bad news,
mm-hmm.
it's fascinating to me that the visit almost always ends with hugs all around.
Right.
It's incredible, and that's also very reinforcing to us, because as difficult as this is, mm-hmm. we know that people really appreciate it, and they're able then to put their lives in order and really emphasize the important things in their lives.
That is so true, because I believe myself that the more information that we have, that leads us to learning about more information and processes to just really work with good communication skills, really have compassion for that person. My biggest issue sometimes when I'm helping families with communication is I want them to understand that person didn't go from a proficient human being to a deficient human being. They just have some issues, and we need to use kindness and compassion to help them through that. Education goes a long way.
Education is very, very important, because mm-hmm. people in this situation usually find themselves in sort of a new forest and a new jungle.
Sure.
And they feel very lost. Even people who have had dementia in their families and who have spent time taking care of people with dementia, when it affects themselves or their spouse, it's really a different situation. So to remind them and to help them learn about all the resources that are available for them and how they can emphasize the things and support the things in their lives that are meaningful to them is a real relief.
Right. And so what is the role of Aricept, Namenda, and Exelon? I know there's a lot of questions around this for families. Some people believe that this is an end-all, but they are not cures for this disease, and they are definitely not going to maybe change and reverse it, but these are questions that people have. We're going to go to break in just a minute, but when we come back, I'd like you to think about how you might answer what is the efficacy of Aricept and Namenda and Exelon? What do they do? What don't they do? And just explain that. Would you do that for me when we come back?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Living and working with Alzheimer's and other dementias can often be challenging. Summit Resilience Training provides education utilizing non-medical approaches for those who work with our friends affected by dementia. Believing families still need one-on-one assistance, we provide classes which help them understand the diseases affecting their loved ones, offering strategies and techniques for success with activities of daily living and working with confusing behaviors. We offer in-home assessments to clarify symptoms of dementia diseases and help families work together to find moments of joy while living with memory loss and impairment. Education programs instilling person-centered care philosophies are offered for professional caregivers working in communities and homes, which can be customized for their staff. Training is also available for first responders, such as law enforcement, fire, and EMT personnel. We are passionate that people with dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and others, are approached with compassion and understanding, and those who work with them have all the tools they need for success. Call us at Summit Resilience Training, 303-420-6988, to schedule a class or in-home assessment. Visit our website at summitresiliencetraining.com for more information.
It's time for Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Okay, we're back, and I have Dr. Jonathan Woodcock with me from the Rocky Mountain Alzheimer's Disease Center. And he not only works in the clinic working with patients, but he's also on the research side as well. So when we were going to break, I was asking you about the three pharmaceutical drugs of 191 that have come through the systems in the past and are currently used for people with Lewy body dementia and Alzheimer's dementia. What is their efficacy and what is their purpose?
We now have two categories of medications that have been on the market for quite some time. They've been approved for quite some time for these conditions. Aricept and Exelon are basically kissing cousins. They're very closely related. Exelon is available in a patch form, so people, if they have trouble with the medicine by mouth, can sometimes try it by patch. And Namenda or memantine is the other drug, which has a different mechanism of action. Unfortunately, these medicines don't cure the disease. They probably slow it down a little bit. And the way I think I can summarize the research is that people on these medicines probably can maintain a community function for 1 to 2 years longer when they're on these medicines. So that can make a big difference in for both the individual as well as for all the people who have this. Keeping people with dementia in meaningful activities for 1 to 2 years longer is substantial.
Absolutely.
And they may slow down the medicine, or rather the disease process a little bit, but they don't cure it. So we're looking for much better drugs. Usually when people start these drugs, they don't even feel a clinical benefit. Some people do. Maybe a quarter to a third of the people feel a little bit better on it. Unfortunately, when people stop the medicine, even if they don't feel they've had a benefit, they sometimes get worse, which is one of the reasons we think the medicines are making a difference. Mm-hmm. But they're not cure-alls, they're not miracles, and we're still looking for medications that will be available to prevent the disease and to stop its progression.
Right. And I have said to my listeners before, if your doctor has given you this medication, a prescription for the medication, and you've been on it for a while, don't just remove yourself from it. Use your clinician to help you if you want to wean off of that drug. Here's something that I've wondered a lot about. Younger onset. My mom was diagnosed at 58. And typically, people that have the disease younger than 65 have a less time period that they're going to live. Is that a fair statement?
That is fair. However, the variability is so great that we do see folks who have earlier onset who have a very slow course. So one of the things we pay a lot of attention to is how things have developed over time. Mm-hmm. Because when that course or momentum of the disease has been established, it tends to maintain itself over the course of the disease. So people who start off with a slower course tend to continue to have a slower course as well.
Oh, okay. So younger onset doesn't necessarily mean that you have a, you know, 8 to 10 year window. It just depends on whether it's a fast progressing course or a slower one.
Pretty much that's true.
Okay.
As you said, folks who have a younger onset sometimes do have a more rapid course, and we don't understand why that is now. It used to be thought that people, particularly with Alzheimer's disease, who had an earlier onset, had a different disease process than people with a later disease onset. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty certain now that that's not the case, that this is one disease that has a pretty similar course for most people. There are several different types of presentation and types of cognitive problems that can occur. But even in younger onset patients, the course tends to be rather similar for those who have a later onset in their 70s or 80s.
I would say in my own personal experience, that would be true. We talked about this when we were coming up here to the studio today about my mom having this disease for 23 years. So for your clinical trials that you work with Dr. Huntington Potter with, you need people with mild cognitive impairment. Now that is actually kind of a skill that somebody would say to themselves, I think I'm starting to see the beginning diseases of this and see it in the earlier stages. Do you typically see people in the very early stages, or do you see people in the later stages?
We see people through this entire continuum. We have folks who come in who have really quite mild symptoms, again, mm-hmm. where the spouse will say, well, I'm not really sure there's anything any different. And so we might call that subjective cognitive problems.
Okay.
People feel themselves that they have cognitive problems, but we really find a normal examination and what we would call normal cognitive aging. So we find that the cognitive abilities are really what could be expected at that age. But sometimes people also have another process going on. For instance, they may be on a medication that's causing their cognitive problems.
Right.
And sometimes we keep in mind that we cure more dementia by stopping medicines than by doing anything else.
that's a good answer.
So looking at the medications is very important. Sometimes
sure.
people have other problems like depression or anxiety, which can interfere with cognitive function. Sometimes they have significant sleep disorders, which are actually quite common.
Mm-hmm.
And which, when addressed, can improve cognitive function. And then there are other things that are less common, but we do pick up also such as infections, chronic infections, and vitamin deficiencies, things like that.
Right. So are you looking for people in the early stages or mild cognitive impairment stages for your research?
Research in general, and our studies in particular, are moving earlier and earlier in the course of the disease process. And at the present time, there are in the planning stages some large studies that will be actually in the pre-symptomatic phase. That is before people have symptoms. And when you think about it, people don't know what's going to happen next, and people without symptoms don't go to see the doctor.
Well, that's true. Don't you think it's important, I'm sure you think it's important, that you study someone through the entire course of their disease if you possibly can? It's why, for example, you don't necessarily just want someone's brain, when they die for science, because you haven't been able to see how they lived.
Exactly. Looking at a brain without a lot of clinical information, of course, looking at the brain after someone's died, is of really not very much benefit.
Right.
One of the studies that we are conducting is run by one of our research and clinical neuropsychologists, Dr. Betcher,
mm-hmm.
and it's called the BioAD study, or the biomarker study for Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And here we begin to follow people either with mild cognitive impairment or who are what we call normal controls, who don't have any problems yet or possibly
mm-hmm.
ever.
Right.
And they come back every year throughout their lives for extensive evaluations.
Right.
These kinds of studies are occurring in Alzheimer's disease centers across the country, so we can get detailed information about how these problems develop over time.
I really understand why that would be beneficial to you, just watching my mom go through this disease and just some of the symptoms that she had, the way we worked with her, and the way she changed over the course of time can really make a difference all the way around. I found it really fascinating that we used a 14-point system with my mom to understand where she was in the course of the disease. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more. I have a few more questions for you that my listeners have wanted to have answered for a long time. We'll be right back. Hey friends, I'm excited to tell you about Pine Grove Crossing Assisted Living and Memory Care in Parker, Colorado. They set the bar high for person-centered care. They're locally owned and they focus on exceeding their residents' expectations while providing excellent dining, housekeeping, and transportation services. Their care team with licensed nurses are available 16 hours per day, 7 days a week, to ensure clinical needs are addressed as soon as possible. Check them out at pinegrovecrossing.com or 303-996-8000 and see how care goes into everything they do.
It's time for Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Today I've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Woodcock from the Rocky Mountain Alzheimer's Disease Center. And Jonathan works not only with the patients, but on the research side. Can you explain what your role is with Dr. Huntington Potter and how you work together?
We sometimes describe this kind of clinical work and research as translational. And that term people may hear when they come to the university hospital and to the clinical research center refers to the translation of research from the laboratory, where it starts in the test tube literally, and then with cell cultures, and then with animal models, mm-hmm. to the clinic,
right,
where we begin to look at the things that have been looked at in the laboratory in people. That is a very extensive process. There's really a huge research infrastructure that's built up in every university that does this kind of research to allow it to occur. There are considerable concerns, of course, about patient safety, mm-hmm. and we want patients sure. to be well informed about the basis of the research, the risks that are involved, the responsibilities that they're taking on when they participate in clinical research, as well as all the things we don't know. And of course, when we're doing research, we don't know all that we need to know about side effects and things like that. That being said, we find that the people who come to us interested in clinical research are very, very highly motivated. These are people who are very, very interested in what we're doing and are really our collaborators in research.
I love that. That's all about resilience. It's all about wanting to find a positive outcome for whatever their situation is. And overcoming that is huge. Yeah.
That is absolutely right. But it really even goes beyond that, because the nature of these trials is that they're randomized. So not everybody gets the active drug. Some
sure.
people get the placebo. Furthermore, we don't know whether or not the active drug is going to help them or, for that matter, hurt them. We don't know what the right dose is, which is why we're doing all of this research.
Right.
So these people are participating not primarily to help themselves, but to help everybody else.
Well, that is so true. I mean, we can't find a cure if we don't have millions of people. We need millions of people. I know there are only thousands, hundreds, whatever, but we need people to get into trialmatch.com, find a research trial that works for you in your area. This show airs nationwide and worldwide, so people, please get on your computer, look at trialmatch.com, and get involved in finding a cure. All right, I want to ask you this question, and it's a little deeper. Several years back, there was something called the Pittsburgh B complex that was developed, and it was used to be able to see live Alzheimer's in the brain. Now, a little bird has told me that you have some folks in your lab that have created something like that, but its efficacy is only 30 minutes to get it from the lab to you. Is that true?
Well, Pittsburgh B compound was the first successful compound to be developed to what we call label the amyloid protein, mm-hmm. which is a marker of Alzheimer's disease in
right.
people's brains. So this can be given through the vein. It goes to the brain. It sticks to the amyloid, and it's been labeled with a radioactive element, carbon, which allows us to see where that amyloid is in the brain. And it is something that is manufactured in the neurochemistry lab and the radiochemistry lab at the university. It goes over to the PET scan, and then this kind of study can be done. But it does have a short half-life. And for that reason, it can't be used for very long after it's made. So people do literally run around the campus from where it's made to the PET scanner so that it can be given. there are similar compounds that have been developed by industry which use a different radioactive label and last longer. So they can be even flown across the country rather than run across the campus.
Well, either way, I think that's exciting. Because I think if you can actually see it in the brain, that I hope has given you a new way of looking at this disease and other diseases. Is that true? I mean, for me, it seems like that would be very exciting as a clinician and as a researcher that you can actually see this now and understand what you're dealing with.
What we're seeing is this thing we call a biomarker. I've used that term several times. Mm-hmm. Alzheimer's disease itself is a pathological process, a disease process which occurs in the brain. We can't see that because we don't have a microscope to look at the brain. Uh-huh. So we have to use all this information to decide whether or not the person probably has Alzheimer's disease. There are a lot of complications with the use of biomarkers. For instance, we know that about 30% of older people have amyloid in their brain, but they don't have clinical Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes things very complicated because
sure.
If people knew that they had the Alzheimer's, or rather the amyloid protein in their brain, they would possibly think that something terrible is going to happen right around the corner. And that's not necessarily the case.
And that's the anxiety that we don't want, right?
That is.
Yeah.
This last year, the Alzheimer's Association and Medicare got together to look at that particular issue. And 18,000 patients around the country had these scans, and there was careful follow-up of how the physicians who were treating them were considering their disease and what they did in terms of orders, and then also how often the patients had to go to the hospital after getting these scans so that we could understand more information about how helpful these scans actually are. And we don't have the results back from that or a decision from Medicare as to whether they're going to pay for these scans.
Well, I really appreciate you lining all this out for us today and explaining everything to us, because it can be very confusing. And I just want my listeners to understand that we're making some real steps forward in how we work with this disease and even how researchers are working with this disease. Now, hey, before I get off the air here today, I want to tell you, please write it down. The University of Colorado Hospital and the Neurology Supportive and Palliative Care Division is presenting a class for caregivers, which I will be giving. And it's about strategies and techniques for successful communication. This is a free event. You do not have to have a diagnosis of the disease. But they would like you to call Julie Burke if you want to register at 303-724-0510. I'll give you that number again in just a minute. But if you have Parkinson's, atypical Parkinson's, Parkinsonian-isms, I can never get that word out, Alzheimer's, or the loved one that you're working with or the person you care for has some type of memory loss and you're concerned about it, you can come to this class. Now again, it's Tuesday, December 4th from 3 to 5 p.m. at the University of Colorado Health Department Outpatient Pavilion, room 2006, called Julie Burke, at 303-724-0510 to register. All right. Well, this has been a fabulous conversation with you today, Jonathan. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I
hope it's helpful for your listeners.
You do great work out there. And I love having all the doctors and the researchers that have come on and all the resources that I have for people every week and in and week out. I just think it helps a lot with our communication skills and so on and so forth. All right, folks. I will see you next week on Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
You've been listening to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz. Visit her website at summitresiliencetraining.com to learn more, and join us next week as we learn more about dementia, Alzheimer's, and overcoming obstacles with a positive outcome. See you next time.